Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very much looking forward to my conversation with James Griffiths about his book titled Speak Not, Empire Identity and the Politics of Language, out last year, 2021, from Bloomsbury. As you can probably guess from the title, this book really investigates minority languages, politically minority languages, and the kind of current state of them, the historical state of them, some that have seen revitalization efforts like Welsh, and others that might be under more significant threat now, and really helps us understand how languages become at risk, what happens when they're at risk, and what might be done about it. So this is a fascinating book for historians, for people interested in current politics, and many other things. So James, I'm very pleased to welcome you to the podcast to tell us more about it.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a bit and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, I'm a journalist. I live in Hong Kong. I've been based in Asia for about a decade, covering China broadly and then also other countries in Asia. I previously wrote a book on internet censorship in China called The Great Firewall of China. And I cover a lot of things like politics and human rights in this region. This book is a slightly more personal book for me, though it's still a work of journalism, it's a work of nonfiction. But it's because I am originally from Ynys Môn in North Wales and grew up as a Welsh speaker that I've always had this interest in, minority languages, because Welsh is a minority language, but just languages more broadly and kind of conscious about the politics around languages. And that inspired me to write this book when I realized that a lot of the conversation around Cantonese, which is the dominant language in Hong Kong, that a lot of that conversation and the concerns around it were very similar to those that I've heard around Welsh growing up and all my life. And I kind of wanted to dig into why that's the case.
So obviously you've mentioned, or I guess not obviously, but you have mentioned two languages, and unsurprisingly, the both of them are in the book, Welsh and Cantonese. What other languages are included in the book, and how did you choose the ones in addition to kind of the two that you have the connections with, you've already described?
So Welsh and Cantonese were always going to be in the book, but both because, you know, Welsh is the language that I speak, that I grew up speaking, and Cantonese is the language of the place that I live and where I would do most of my reporting. And then I will try to find a third language, which was in a different situation, kind of politically and I guess kind of in terms of revitalization or kind of strength wise, but had some similarities with Welsh and Cantonese in terms of geography, I guess, and kind of culture and kind of the way that it was spoken. So what I ended up with was Hawaiian, and that might seem like an odd choice, but it felt natural to me in that Wales, Hong Kong, and Hawaii are all kind of three relatively self-contained communities, territories that are on the edge of a very large empire and of kind of more homogenous and homogenizing empire, it being, you know, the British Empire in the case of Welsh, China in the case of Hong Kong, and the American Empire in the case of Hawaii. So those kind of seem to fit, and it enabled me to look at similarities and look at differences in terms of language politics and language revitalization and language suppression across these different, very different places, that, you know, and try and see what's common and what's different. And then there's also what I call kind of, you know, there's also, God, what do I call them? Interludes. There's also what I call interludes in the books, which looks at a couple of other languages. So I look at Afrikaans in South Africa, because it's a very interesting story of a language which was first suppressed, then became the language of apartheid, became the language of suppression, and then has now, since democracy in South Africa, has become very much a minority and, you know, increasingly minoritized language there. So it's a very interesting story to follow. And then I also look at the fate of Yiddish and Hebrew, kind of the two Jewish languages, and how they've intersected, and also the kind of what's happened to both the Yiddish, which has kind of fallen out of strength and favor in the state of Israel, and obviously Hebrew, which has become the official language of that country, and so how that connects to language politics and suppression and things like that.
Well, so this is fascinating, obviously. I think it's a really interesting mix of languages that gives us a lot to talk about in terms of different places, different times, but also a lot of threads that are similar amongst them. So I think we're probably going to get to see some of those in this interview, though obviously we're not going to be able to go into all the detail that the book does. So I will point listeners to the book for all the details about it, particularly the interludes and some of the more in the history, if there are any of those languages that listeners may be less familiar with. But I want to start still with one of these areas sort of similarity, because of course, we've already sort of touched on the idea that these languages are minorities in a lot of cases because of geography and population, but it's not just that, right? There's politics involved. There's active suppression involved. And one thing I was struck by reading the book was essentially how similar a lot of the arguments are across time and space about why a particular language is seen as bad, really. So I was wondering if you could kind of break down for us, help us understand, what are those kinds of arguments against a language? How does a language go from being minority to minoritized?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a good distinction to make, in that, you know, there are, you know, thousands of languages spoken around the world. Often many of those are, you know, minority languages spoken by very small populations. And that can be because maybe they're an immigrant language that's spoken by a small immigrant community, or they are a language which has become smaller because of, you know, the ties of geography and of politics. And there are languages that have been pushed into minority status, so, which have been actively suppressed. And that tends to happen as part of an imperial project, part of a colonial project. And so, yeah, in the instance of the three languages that I look at in particular, Welsh, Cantonese, and Hawaiian, that is absolutely the case, that these are all languages that are, Cantonese is still in a relatively position of strength, but we can talk about why that's interesting later. But, you know, in terms of Welsh and Hawaiian, they were languages which were the dominant spoken language in the country where they are, and were suppressed and pushed into minority status through colonialism. And, you know, that tends to happen for a number of reasons. You know, there is the obvious kind of population change which happens with colonialism. You know, if you bring a bunch of English-speaking immigrants into Wales and Hawaii, that is going to change the language makeup of the country. But also there tends to be a active political kind of project to change the language that the indigenous and native populations speak as well. And that tends to have two main arguments behind it. One is this idea that without a common language, you wouldn't have a kind of common national project, that, you know, if you want to have greater cohesion, if you want to make Wales part of the United Kingdom, or, you know, part of England, which is what they were trying to make it originally, you know, everyone needs to speak English. That, you know, that to get people to better integrate, you need them all to speak the same language. And that was also, you know, the argument for promoting English in Hawaii after it was annexed by the United States. And then kind of concurrently with that, there's also this argument you would often hear and often read, that you know, that for people to succeed economically in these countries, they will need to speak the, you know, the language of the winner, essentially, that, you know, if you want to take part in the imperial economy or the colonial economy, you need to speak their language. And so that speaking your own language somehow is a disadvantage. And one thing's, and then there's, and there's also a kind of third strand, which is this kind of social Darwinist idea that certain languages are, you know, weaker or inferior to others, and that, that, you know, we're simply swapping a losing horse for a winning one by adopting this stronger imperial language. And one thing that's kind of shared between all of those, of course, and may have already occurred to people listening, is this kind of refusal to acknowledge the idea of bilingualism, that, you know, you can gain the, you can get the economic benefits of speaking a language, you know, we're speaking English, we can get the economic benefits of speaking English without losing your own language or without sacrificing your own language. But there is this very strange idea that until surprisingly recently, this idea that you could promote bilingualism as a kind of national policy was very rare.
Which is particularly interesting when you think further back in history, when bilingualism or multilingualism was kind of a normal thing, and we didn't have this attachment of state, citizenship, and language all bundled up together. So it is interesting to think about kind of, we didn't used to have it, then we did very, very strongly, and now we're maybe kind of moving away from that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, with the rise of the nation state in kind of the 19th century and into the 20th century, and you get this idea of states that are formed around, you know, ethnic groups and languages, and that you tend to have a dominant language or even a single language per country. And this becomes a kind of unifying force. And it is a useful unifying force. I won't, you know, deny it does it, it when you're looking at it from a kind of pure zero sum, you know, math problem for as a ruler of a state, and you want to unify everyone, then yeah, getting them all to speak the same language can be a useful way of doing that. But this was kind of seen as the only way to do it, and was the modern thing to do. And this idea, which kind of sprung up in Europe and then spread around the world, has been quite destructive, and I think has increasingly been pushed back upon. And yeah, and like you said, we're kind of we adopted this very, very strongly for a while, and now it's starting to fade away, thankfully.
Mm. Well, so I'd like to talk about an instance of that, right? The quite stringent application of the idea of one language, and sort of how it led to pushback and revitalization. And of course, we have to start in Wales for a number of reasons. And there's a lot to get into with Wales, so we're probably not going to go into the entire history of the fight for the Welsh language and its revitalization efforts. But I would love to ask you about the Blue Books and sort of what they were, what they were trying to do, and how you see them leading to a pushback and a revitalization of the Welsh language.
Yeah, so the Blue Books, as they're known, which are officially a report of the Commissioners of Inquiry into the State of Education in Wales, which were published in 1847. They're commissioned by the British government, though, of course, there was no distinction then. There was only one government in London. And that this was in response to concern of the state of education in Wales. Nothing specifically to do with language. Just they were initially launched to look at, you know, how good are schools in this country? You know, what problems is this causing? And, you know, what they pretty much found was that the state of education was terrible, that the schools were very, very poor condition across Wales, that children were getting a very bad education for most states, and they were very deprived in a lot of the country. It's important to note that had you done, and people did do, the same kind of research in England and Scotland at the same time, you would find pretty much the same thing. This is a problem with education in the 19th century, not so much a problem with education in Wales. But one of the kind of faults that the inquirers zeroed in on, or one of the things they found to blame for the poor state of education in Wales, was not so much funding or, you know, resources or, you know, anything that we might kind of identify now, but was this idea that it was the Welsh language itself which was holding children back and holding the country back. And so the books, when the reports, when they were released, were very, very critical of the Welsh language, and essentially said that this is something that needs to be done away with if Wales is ever going to, you know, fully industrialise and modernise. And they became known in Wales as it became known as the treason of the Blue Books. It became known in Wales as the Treason of the Blue Books, or Brad y Llyfrau Gleision, which kind of gives you an idea of just how violently people reacted to this intimation that it was the Welsh language which was to blame for all the flaws in the country. And while they did have a very negative effect on educational and language policy coming down from Westminster, and they did have a long effect they had a severe effect on education and language policy in Wales for decades to come. They also promoted this kind of pushback to them, which we now see as the kind of planting the seeds of the Welsh language movement and the Welsh language, eventual Welsh language revitalization.
So one of the fascinating things about the book is that you sort of trace where these seeds come, and then they sort of are attempted, and you look at sort of the things that didn't work as well as some of the things that did, to help us understand that language revitalization movements, like many movements, are not sort of linear progress, and are much more complicated to kind of understand in the midst of. And so looking back can be quite helpful to understanding other efforts, or at least that's one of my impressions from the book. And so I was wondering if you could tell us about kind of something that happened in this process that at the time it sounds like was sort of seen as an impactful moment, but probably not something that people thought would have quite the legacy that it has. And this is particularly, I was wondering if you could tell us about what happened in February 1962, a radio address.
Yeah, so in February 1962, Saunders Lewis, who is a founder of Plaid Cymru, the Welsh Nationalist Party, and is a lifelong kind of proponent of the Welsh language and activist on the Welsh language, he'd gone to prison for protests that he'd staged around promoting the use of Welsh, and had been involved in a number of key pieces of activism. He was also a longtime broadcaster, a writer, and an incredibly impactful cultural figure as well. But in 1962, he was kind of getting towards the end of his life. He makes this broadcast, which is called Tunga de Iaith, kind of the state of the language, and so Welsh language broadcast. And he talks about the history up till then of the Welsh language movement and of trying to, what was very much then at the time was a kind of, rearguard movement against, trying to really fighting what felt like a losing battle. And he makes quite dire predictions about where this is going to go, that if they continue on the same trajectory that the language was going in then, that Welsh would die out. I think he says around the turn of the millennium. One of the things he's arguing for is a more sustained activism and a much stronger effort to protect the Welsh language. There's this fantastic quote from the speech where he says, "Is the position hopeless? It is, of course, if we're content to give up hope. There is nothing in the world more comfortable than to give up hope, for then one can go on to enjoy life." And so he kind of argues that, look, we've been pushing back against the encroachment of English and against the suppression of Welsh for decades now, and we haven't really made much headway. And if we don't kind of pull ourselves together and try much harder, then the trajectory is very, very bad. And he kind of outlines the way that he would see people doing this, which is a lot more kind of civil disobedience. It's a lot more active activism. So rather than just, bemoaning the replacement of Welsh by English, it's actively pushing back. So refusing to pay taxes if they're only requested in English, refusing to engage in anything that the government does unless that it's in Welsh. This broadcast has a huge, huge effect. It really is the trigger which launches the modern Welsh language movement. Off the back of it, we quickly get a group called Cymdeithas y Iaith, which is the Welsh Language Society, and they kind of drive this campaign through the 1960s and 70s of civil disobedience, of tearing down road signs which are only in English, of refusing to pay taxes, staging protests. A lot of people go to prison for this. And it has such an effect that by the time Saunders Lewis died in 1985, when he was 92, there was a Secretary of State for Wales. Plaid Cymru had sent 9 members of parliament to Westminster. The Welsh language was recognised in court, and there was a new publicly funded radio and television channel in Welsh. And so, that is obviously not solely down to him, but it is in a huge part inspired and, pushed forward by his broadcast in 1962.
That was a really interesting example, I think, of kind of, in a lot of ways, a sort of community elder is obviously a bit too simplistic, but sort of someone who's spent a lot of time working on a thing and has committed a lot to it, and yet sees that there is possibility, but also dire possibility as well as hopeful ones. And so there's rather a lot of similarities, I think, to looking at the Hawaiian language and how close it came to extinction under colonialism, but also how it's been revitalized as well. So I was wondering if you could outline for us a bit kind of how close the Hawaiian language got to becoming extinct, and sort of who were some of the key figures, and how did we get to a place where it looks like it's being revitalized now?
When the Hawaiian Islands were annexed by the United States and became first a territory and eventually a state of America, you know, Hawaiian language was already in a minority status. A lot of that was because of immigration, a huge amount of immigration, both from the US mainland, but also from Asia, other countries in Asia. And so it was in a relatively vulnerable state. And then, you know, come annexation, there is a coup against the last indigenous monarch, and she is overthrown. And the kind of white American coup leaders who take over, they ban the Hawaiian language, and they suppress it because it is seen as connected to Hawaiian sovereignty and Hawaiian nationalism. And they want to kind of suppress that as much as possible because, you know, essentially they're stealing this country and eventually, you know, sign it over to the United States, which we should note has admitted that this was illegal and that they annexed Hawaii illegally, but they, you know, don't intend to give it back. And so when Hawaii was annexed, there was this active suppression of Hawaiian in a similar way to Welsh. You know, it was banned, its uses was banned in schools, it was banned, it was not a language of the law anymore, you couldn't use it in courts and things like that, and it very quickly fell from favor. It stopped being spoken. You had a lot of indigenous Hawaiian families would grow up not speaking it, and the situation actually became much more dire than Welsh because Hawaii is a lot smaller, and because of the kind of ways that the population broke down and things like that, that there wasn't that. Whereas in Wales, you had these kind of strong agricultural communities in the north and west, where Welsh kind of remained a dominant tongue well into the 19th century and 20th century. In Hawaii, and it was kind of being, there was pressure on from all sides, and it was dying out very quickly, to the extent that when the Hawaiian language revitalization movement starts, around the kind of 1960s, that they had to, there was an effort to get Hawaiian back into schools and to teach the next generation Hawaiian. But whereas in Wales, it's much more a focus on, okay, this is just, we're talking about policy, and we're talking about the legal ability to do these things, that there was the capacity within the community, they just needed the right to do it. In Hawaii, it reached such a dangerous situation that when they set up these things called language nests, which are essentially Hawaiian language kindergartens, they had to get, you know, elders, grandparents of the children in the school in to speak to them, because the intervening generation did not speak Hawaiian. And some of these people were very, very old and, you know, were on the verge of death. And that's kind of, you know, they really did come basically one generation away from the language going extinct. Because if you had you not had this elder generation, which would have come in and could teach these children the language, then you're talking about language kind of resurrection, or, you know, promoting a dead language, which is a far, far, far more difficult process than revitalizing an existing language. And so, yeah, the situation for Hawaiian was extremely dire and came very close to tipping over the edge, and, you know, is still in a much more vulnerable situation than Welsh.
I think it's interesting, the idea of the difference between revitalizing a language versus resurrecting a dead one, because of course one of the interludes you already spoke about is Hebrew, which anyone who knows anything about Hebrew, modern Hebrew, has not a ton to do with biblical Hebrew. They're rather different languages, and you detail in the book kind of just how extreme an effort it took to get Hebrew to where it is today. I mean, essentially the entire force of a state, really, over multiple decades and multiple generations. So that, I think that really highlights just how close, in a lot of senses, Hawaiian came, given that we can guess kind of that sort of level of effort probably wouldn't have happened to revitalize Hawaiian.
No, absolutely not. And Hebrew is so interesting because Hebrew is your kind of rare, extremely rare example of a minority, and you might argue dead language, being adopted by a state as the, you know, homogenizing, you know, language of nationalism. You know, that doesn't normally happen, you know, but potentially, you know, if we suddenly saw indigenous Hawaiians gain sovereignty over the Hawaiian Islands, that maybe, you know, we might see Hawaiians suddenly become the official language, but that's pretty unlikely. And, you know, and it's even less likely, you know, I don't think anyone in the kind of 18th century would have predicted that, oh, the Hebrew will suddenly become the language of a, you know, of a Jewish state, because even at that time, it seemed insane, you know, that most you know, the majority of Jews around the world, if they spoke a Jewish language, it was Yiddish. It was not Hebrew. And so, you know, the unlikelihood of Hebrew becoming, you know, not only becoming revitalized and revived, but being the, you know, official language of a country was you know, extremely low.
And I think also one thing that's worth mentioning as a thread, though we're probably not going to get much more into it, is I don't love the sort of great man theory of history and that everything comes down to particular individuals. And I think a lot of the points you've made so far about institutions, you know, things being what is the language of governance and government is really important. But it's also worth mentioning that, like Lewis and Wales, every one of these stories does have some really quite strong-willed individuals involved in preserving language, both when there is an opportunity to kind of then revitalize it, but perhaps more importantly, when it looks like there really is no chance of it coming back. And so I would definitely point readers who are interested in those kinds of stories to the book to learn about, for example, some very strong-willed Hawaiian grandmothers, a probably pretty obsessive Jewish immigrant to what became Israel and his very determined plans for his child, among others, to think about kind of the combination, I suppose, of the individual and the institutional in a lot of these efforts. And that remains true kind of if we continue our geographic journey across the Pacific Ocean to China, because one of the things the book talks about is the many efforts in the late 1800s and early 1900s to reform the Chinese language, again, at the institutional and the individual level. Can you help us understand why there were so many different attempts in this time period?
Yes, it is a very complicated story. And I think the Chinese section of the book is the part of the book where I had to go back into history kind of the most and really lay out kind of the threads of how we got to the modern conversation around Chinese languages and language revitalization in that region. Chinese is a very complicated language and language family to talk about because you have what is essentially a shared written language across a number of spoken languages, which are often are related and sometimes are not that related. But come kind of towards the end of the Qing dynasty, the last imperial dynasty to rule over China, you have a shared written language, so what people think of as Chinese when they think about it written down, that is used throughout the empire and is understood throughout the empire by, you know, literate and educated people, but you have a whole, you know, dozens and dozens of spoken languages. So in the south, the main language is the Ye family or Cantonese language family, you know, up kind of towards Shanghai, people speaking Shanghaihua and kind of these languages of that region. And then up in the north, they're speaking the Mandarin family of languages and what would become modern Mandarin. But I say that because at the time it was not. It was just one of multiple spoken versions of this language, which use a common written language. I'm trying to be as non-confusing as possible, but it is quite a confusing thing to talk about. And the reason that there were efforts or repeated and, you know, multiple efforts to reform this was the sense that there were two problems, basically. One was that the written language is very complicated. This is traditional Chinese, so this is before people may be familiar with simplified Chinese, which is used in the People's Republic. And so, but this is not that version. It is the traditional version of Chinese, which is more complex characters. It's more difficult to learn. And because there was not a unified spoken language across the country, or there wasn't a dominant spoken language across the country, it could be quite difficult to teach it, because you're teaching someone, say, to read written Chinese in their own local language or dialect. And that's not, you know, that's not going to be the same. That's not going to be consistent across the country. You know, you can teach people to read it in Mandarin up in the north. That, you know, from an educational policy perspective, that's not going to be this. That's not going to be very applicable in the South, where they don't really speak Mandarin. And you know, this had really been kind of, this had worked out fine, really, for the empires for a long. You know, these were, you know, some of the largest empires in the world. You know, it wasn't too big of a problem. They managed to administer these huge empires with this written languages and with a handful of kind of common spoken languages, but. As China modernized, and especially kind of as we transition from the Qing dynasty into the early Republican era, there was this recognition that that this was potentially a hindrance, that the language had become difficult to learn. It was difficult. It was causing problems with literacy, because it was a very difficult language to pick up, as anyone that studied even modern Chinese will know. It's a difficult language to come at from nothing. And there was a sense that they needed to do something about this, because this was holding the country back. They looked at Japan, which had made similar, or had made a number of reforms to its language, both in a written and spoken variety, and had, you know, outstripped China in terms of modernization. And then off the back of that, defeated China several times in military activities. And so there was this kind of recognition that, you know, we're losing ground here. We need to reform the language. But then that opens up a whole other can of worms, because, you know, you get various conversations around, well, do we move away from using a character-based system? Should we adopt an alphabet? There was a strong push for a long time to basically adopt the Latin alphabet, or adopt a kind of syllabary based on Chinese, so similar to the... Similar to what is used in Japan, though they still use Chinese characters in Japan, they kind of didn't finish that reform. But then the problem comes up that if you reform the written language to be more similar to what people speak, well, then what's that going to do for kind of national cohesion? Because everyone doesn't speak the same language, and they often speak very different languages. And that if you lose this written language, which is kind of tying everyone together, will that break up the country, essentially? And so you start to have this kind of twin movement, both to reform the written Chinese language and to create a unified spoken language. And that's, from that is what we get Putonghua, which is, we get modern Mandarin, which then gradually became the dominant spoken language across all of the People's Republic of China.
So now that you've explained the very complicated foundations of this, I'm not going to let up on the tricky questions. How was it then, out of kind of this mix, why was it Putonghua? Why was it Mandarin that became kind of the dominant language?
Yeah, so there is a certain bit of historical revisionism that you'll get, particularly from Cantonese speakers, that there's this idea that maybe at one point it was going to be Cantonese, that there was, or another southern language, or but basically Mandarin was always the largest language group in China, is the real answer for how we got Mandarin. It was the language that was spoken in and around Beijing, which is where the capital was for much of that period. It had always been a dominant language in northern China. And so when it came time to pick a language to use as the basis for this kind of national lingua franca, it always made sense to use Mandarin. There was an aborted effort during the Republican era to kind of have a version of, well, Guoyu, which is kind of national language, that was basically Mandarin, but had a few kind of, a few features of some of the other Chinese languages. I'm trying to think of a way to compare that in English, but I mean, I guess it would be like, you know, it'd be like if we spoke a version of English that also has, genders from French or something, or, you know, the way of conjugating verbs from Spanish. It was always a bit of a kind of bastardized version of Mandarin, and it didn't take on because it was just kind of more complicated for people to learn than just to learn this, you know, pre-existing language. that was done away with in the People's Republic. So after 1949, when the People's Republic of China is founded, and they took up this challenge of creating a unifying national language, they call it, you know, Putonghua, which is the common language, but it was basically Beijing Mandarin is what was adopted, and that this was then adopted throughout education. It became the official national language, and we gradually, you know, it came to push out a lot of other languages. Similarly, I guess to the UK and the situation with Welsh, that at first this was just something that happened gradually as children were taught Mandarin, you know, their own language, the kind of local language would maybe decrease in the amount that it was spoken, a decrease in prestige. But as the government started to decide that this wasn't happening fast enough, they started to really aggressively push Mandarin and would start to suppress local languages, and especially kind of in kind of more border areas of China where there was concern about separatism. This was seen as a way to really tie those areas into the rest of the country, to get everyone speaking one language.
So a number of those languages are obviously in quite dire straits, really. Shanghaihua has not a ton of speakers left, but Cantonese seems an unlikely candidate at first glance for concerns about the number of speakers it has. There's rather a lot of speakers, at least at the moment, and it is, as you said at the beginning, one of the main languages in Hong Kong. So why, you know, bring us up to the present. Why are we concerned with Cantonese today? How is this related to other political concerns, for example, in Hong Kong?
Yeah, absolutely. And from a purely numerical standpoint, Cantonese is, you know, in rude health. There's tens of millions of speakers around the world, you know, and it's spoken in multiple countries. And it is spoken by millions of people in China, you know, notwithstanding Hong Kong, that it's spoken by millions of people in southern China. But what's important is that it's no longer the first language of the majority of people in Guangdong, which is where the language originates in southern China. And it is increasingly not spoken by newer generations. And so there's been this real shift in you know, matter of decades in Guangdong from a majority Cantonese speaking province to a majority Mandarin speaking province. And that is somewhat to do with immigration and population changes, but is mostly to do with education policy and kind of national language policy, and so you get these families where maybe definitely the grandparents and maybe the parents will speak Cantonese, but the children probably don't speak it very well. They might understand it but not speak it back. They might not understand it at all, and the language of the household is often, you know, either kind of mostly Mandarin or has shifted completely to Mandarin, and that the generations in the future will almost certainly, you know, only speak Mandarin. And this is a major concern for the entirety of the language, because we're starting to see that shift, which has already happened in Guangdong, so just across the border from Hong Kong. We're starting to see that shift in Hong Kong, that the policies are starting to be adopted and that there is a more and more promotion of Mandarin. And the reason that is a particular concern isn't just for Cantonese speakers in Hong Kong. It's because while there are tens of millions of Cantonese speakers around the world, there is only one kind of cohesive first language community, which is Hong Kong. So really this is a community of six, seven million speakers, and which is a lot, you know, it's still large, but it's a lot smaller than the kind of, you know, 60 odd million around the world. And, you know, one of the things I argue in the book is that larger figure kind of belies the actual vulnerability of the language, because if you lose this first language community in Hong Kong, you're going to lose a lot of the culture that's created in Cantonese, that, you know, this is mostly going to then be a diaspora language, and diasporas are consumers of culture. They're not generally creators and drivers of it. And so that could have a massively negative effect on how Cantonese is spoken around the world. If Hong Kong was to follow the same path that Guangdong has, and there are reasons to think that will happen, that could have a major diminishing effect on Cantonese speakers everywhere. And so to kind of explain why we think this is going to happen in Hong Kong is, you know, people may be aware that the kind of national government, the Chinese government, has, you know, increasingly encroached on the autonomy of Hong Kong. They essentially in the last couple of years have done away with opposition lawmakers and free elections, even to those, the minority of positions that were freely elected in Hong Kong. And, you know, there has been a longstanding kind of drive to promote Mandarin here and to get Hong Kong children speaking Mandarin. And that sometimes that has been met by pushback, both at a political level and a kind of organizing process level. That political pushback is no longer really possible. It seems also that protests are, we haven't had a real protest now since 2019. The legal challenges to that are very, very great. And so without that kind of ability to push back and to organize against this, this is a transformation that could happen quite rapidly. And like I said, this is a transformation that would negatively impact not just Cantonese speakers here, but Cantonese speakers globally.
There are, however, some hopeful, I suppose, elements of what sounds quite dire in that last response. And it's worth thinking about kind of what is available today that may not have been available, or, you know, definitely was not available to revitalization efforts in other cases. For example, mainly the internet. What impact has the internet had on revitalization efforts, you know, both good and bad?
Yeah, so to talk about the good side first, one of the biggest gains we've had from the internet in terms of language revitalization movement is that it's connected people across various groups that you know, in the past it was, you know, potentially impossible and also just unlikely that someone from a minority language in North America would talk to someone from a minority language in Europe and, you know, would share experiences and share skills and share kind of stories. That with the internet, that barrier has completely gone away, and there is a very kind of active, you know, kind of cross-cultural minority language movement. You know, thinking of things like Wiki Tongues and various other groups, and that's very useful because people can share experiences, they can share tactics and things like that, and they can also act as a kind of warning. You know, one of the reasons I was so keen to write about Cantonese in the book is both because obviously I live here and I'm immersed in this community, but also because I think Cantonese is interesting to look at because this is something where this doesn't have to follow the same path as the other languages in the book. You know, the Welsh and Hawaiian, we're looking at them coming back from a period of you know, weakness and, you know, almost extinction. Cantonese is in a very strong position, but might turn bad in the future. But that hasn't been written yet, right? So there is a potential for Cantonese speakers to kind of see the writing on the wall and protect their language and shore it up against future decline. You know, like I said, so a lot of that is out of their hands in terms of kind of political organizing in Hong Kong, but we're already seeing this kind of effort both online and offline to kind of denationalize or you know, globalize the Cantonese language movement so that there are, you know, efforts to shore it up and teach Cantonese in Canada and the UK and things like that. And that I think is coming off the back of having that idea of you know, global language communities and of global language efforts. And another side, from a kind of purely technological perspective, the tools for language revitalization, so, you know, proper education, you know, education resources, apps for learning the languages, you know, things like just, you know, support for using your browser or your, you know, mobile phone in your language. Those can have a huge effect on revitalization and on, you know, helping people learn a language or help people practice a kind of heritage language. And that support isn't always there. But what's remarkable, and I think what is very encouraging, is that the more languages you do this for, and, you know, we're already at the kind of hundreds and thousands stage of you know, support for languages online, the more languages you do this for, the easier it gets, because you develop technological tools for, say, displaying a certain type of alphabet or displaying a certain type of character system, or you find ways of teaching, you know, this type of quirk that this language has, and that the next time that comes along, it's already there and it's easier. And so with that, we're seeing real kind of progress in terms of developing resources online and of, you know, teaching people languages and helping to spread languages online, you know, and even things like, you know, Zoom, everyone's got used to using video conferencing over the last 3 years. Well, that's had a huge boon for language revitalization, because it was often quite difficult to connect speakers of especially really, really tiny languages, because they were often very, very spread out, or there were only kind of a handful of communities, say, across Canada, when we talk about some Indigenous languages, and they were very difficult to connect. And it was difficult, especially to get elders to connect with young people who might be living in a city that's, you know, hundreds of miles away from the traditional home of the community. And now, because there is that support and there's that kind of familiarization with internet conferencing, video conferencing, that has become a lot easier. And so actually, you know, I said I'd focus on the positive, but actually I'd say that this is actually, I think, perhaps showing that the negative case for the internet and technology in terms of language revitalization is maybe overstated, because the great fear there was this idea which is called digital language death. And that is basically where a language doesn't make the leap from offline to online, so that yes, this is a language that you and I might speak when we're walking around together, but if I'm using my phone, I can't use it, there isn't any support for it, and so I switch languages. And this is actually interesting, this is a problem that we have in China for very, very different reasons, but that, you know, people use Mandarin to communicate on digital devices even when they don't use Mandarin in that may need to speak. But that has a huge effect on their ability with their own language. But like I said at the beginning of this, sorry, very long and now rambling answer, while there were these legitimate fears of digital language death, I think actually the speed of language digitization and the using advances in AI, using advances in oral programming and language recognition and things like that, audio recognition, that the advances have actually have sped up so much and have become so cheap and so easy to do that we're not seeing actually a lot of those negative kind of situations that were once predicted.
Very interesting, particularly as you noted that fears can be overblown. So it's a useful corrective. There are, it seems, kind of a number of concerns about language, minoritized languages, but also areas for hope. How can we kind of assess that? How hopeful can we be about language revitalization efforts globally?
I think there is a good reason to be hopeful. When we talk about language revitalization, especially, I think there is a strong reason for optimism, because both from a technological perspective, as I just said, and also from a kind of political and you know, educational policy and things like that, there is now this kind of framework. There's this, from a political perspective, when we're talking about educational policy, language policy, there's this framework, there's this blueprint for language revitalization, which can, you know, to a lesser and greater degree, be applied to any language. And so, you know, people that are starting to, you know, you go online and you can find, you know, workbooks and guides on, you know, how to launch a language revitalization movement, you know, how to start promoting your and, you know, working to shore up your Indigenous language or your heritage language. And that's had a huge effect, you know, that it becomes easier. Each kind of new language that takes this up, it is easier than it was 50 years ago. We know we've got a framework for what to do, and we know what needs to be done on a kind of political level, what we need to do in terms of schooling, what needs to be done in terms of resources, things like that. That isn't to say that things are easy. You know, it takes a huge amount of organizing. You're, by the very nature of talking about minority languages, you're obviously talking about minority communities, which don't necessarily have great political representation. Even if they do, don't necessarily have that much kind of impact or influence. You're often kind of depending on a majority community to decide to do this, you know, whether out of kind of, whether out of some kind of idea of reparations or, you know, just promoting kind of indigenous culture or you know, wanting to you know, our shared human culture. But, you know, this isn't, this sometimes is something that minority groups can do themselves, often is something you need government educational support for. So that is difficult. It takes a lot of organizing, takes a lot of effort. But I think the framework is there and the blueprint is there. And that and then there's also these test cases around the world to show that the success is there, that you know, there is reason for optimism, because we can look at languages like Welsh that was dying out and was heading in a very terminal velocity and is now about to hit 1 million speakers for the first time, I think, in like 200 years. You know, this is there is great cause for optimism because there is great success we can look at and say this other language can then follow that same path.
Hmm. That's quite a nice note to end our sort of global investigation exploration on. But before I let you go, I do have two further questions. The first of which is kind of going back to something you said at the beginning, that obviously two of the languages in particular in the book, Welsh and Cantonese, are intellectually interesting, but also have sort of personal resonance to you. And that there are some languages that seem on the surface quite different, and yet you've investigated and uncovered a lot of similarities. So I was wondering a bit about kind of the behind the scenes, the process of writing this book. Was there anything in particular that was surprising to you in the process of finding all this out and putting it together that you could share with us?
I think the biggest surprise for me personally in researching and reporting this book was that the attitude to Welsh especially has changed so much since I was growing up. And, you know, I haven't lived in Wales, I haven't lived in the UK for over a decade. And, you know, you kind of assume that things, you know, stay the same in a certain extent. You apply your own, you know, biases and kind of opinions to these things. And that when I left, you know, the Welsh revitalization was, you know, was well underway, obviously, and it had been underway for decades. And I was one of the beneficiaries of that. I was among the first generations to learn Welsh in school and do all of our schooling in Welsh. But it was still kind of, I think, vulnerable in a way, and almost kind of uncool and not. It didn't have the force behind it that it does now. And so in reporting the book and kind of talking, especially to younger people about Welsh, that there's this kind of confidence in the language now that, you know, that comes from the success that the language revitalization movement has had. But there was this confidence in it that I never knew. And it really connected me personally to this thing that a woman that I interviewed in Hawaii said, that, you know, she had been involved in the language revitalization movement, and her grandchildren were kind of, you know, essentially my generation in terms of Welsh, that they were this generation that were coming up learning Hawaiian, and she kind of told this story about her grandchildren being mocked for speaking Hawaiian in school, and certainly there was a lot of kind of disdain and sometimes mockery of Welsh when I was growing up as well. And you know, she basically told the story that her children kind of turned around and said, look, you know, how can you make fun of us? We speak two languages, you only speak one. Like, you know, if anyone's going to get made fun of, it should be you. And you know, she just said, oh, you know, they just have this confidence in the language and this, you know, they can't imagine it being any other way. They can't imagine, you know, that the language would be vulnerable, that language wouldn't be something to be proud of and something to promote. And that's something that I've seen in Wales as well, and with Welsh. And I think it was hugely encouraging and makes me feel a lot more optimistic about Wales to see how far the Welsh language has come, you know, even in my lifetime, let alone, you know, in all the period that I cover in the book.
What a lovely surprise to come across, and thank you for sharing it with us. My final question is quite simply, the book has been out for a little bit now. Is there another project that's caught your attention? Is there anything you're working on now or next you can give us a sneak preview of?
So I'm not currently working on any book projects. I wrote two books in relatively quick succession and burned myself out thoroughly. I'm a full-time, I cover Asia for a Canadian newspaper, and I'm very, very busy generally reporter. I'm about to fly to cover the G20. And so, yeah, I'm kind of, at the moment, I don't have a book project on the horizon, but I'm sure another one will come along.
Wonderful. Well, while you are off reporting on many different stories, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, which again is titled Speak Not, Empire, Identity and the Politics of Language from Bloomsbury in 2021. James, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you.